Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 54.
54. That's German.
Did you see that new Cirque du Soleil logo they put out last week?
I did. I didn't even notice it was different. It kind of looks like the same. I mean, I guess that's what they were going for. But if you had asked me which was which, I think I did pick the wrong one.
Yeah, it's interesting. For those who haven't seen it, they sort of like made it like into a circle. Like they kept the sun idea, but they didn't. It's no longer like
the flourishes below it are gone.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny. The video is like, we strive here at Cirque du Soleil to be blah, 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 blah. For like a logo change. And then they reveal it and you're like, wait, what? That's it.
You know, but it makes sense because when you're on Instagram, they have like your logo has to be circular.
Yeah. So, they copied us.
Yeah, they copied us. We have a circular Hideaway logo.
Yes, I know they were.
Bloomberg put out an interesting article about Cirque du Soleil because they're opening up this NFL Times Square experience that we're going to go to next week. And we'll let you know in the next episode what we thought of it. But the article talked about TPG, who are the people who now own Cirque du Soleil. And there were two pieces of information I thought our listeners would be interested in.
Cool. I don't know them either, so.
Here you go. The first is that apparently in the last year, their ticket sales, or rather their revenue per seat, has risen 20% thanks to new social media advertising. You believe that?
No. There's no way. No.
You don't think?
Maybe. Wait, so say it again. They said that.
They said tickets are now easier to buy on mobile phones and prices fluctuate. All of this has helped revenue per available seat rise 20% this year.
Well, their ticket prices probably have gone up.
Yep.
So in that sense, yeah, that's probably true. But is it they've gone up because of the higher demand? And also, like, is it actual earned revenue or is it potential revenue? Like, is the potential revenue that they get is higher for each seat or is it actually what they got for each seat is higher?
Well, I think they're hoping we think that it's what they got. Later on in this article, they interview Alina Kavhulia, who is an analyst at Moody's Investor Service. Moody's is that credit rating agency that, you know, rates stuff on Wall Street. And she said that Cirque du Soleil's credit is weakly positioned because of the large amount of debt taken on to complete its leveraged buyout. She thinks Cirque might not actually be doing that well, but that because they're expanding to this NFL experience and this theme park, they have a broader opportunity. But she says, I don't know that it's less risk. So it's interesting that a credit rating agency is a little skeptical on Cirque du Soleil's position.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, I don't know. You know, like when you try to do too many things at once, you don't do any one thing very well.
Yeah.
But so I feel like they're doing a lot of stuff at once and maybe not doing any one thing really well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see the NFL experience because that's really a departure from their thing. It'll be interesting to see if they can do that well.
Right.
I am hoping I can be like, I can pick like the Patriots and like go through the experience as Tom Brady or something.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what that is. I don't know. I mean, I think like just from my experience seeing shows while we're in New York, like they're not full.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were comped when we were there. And, you know, so that's why I think the potential for earned revenue on each seat is probably higher. But if the actual revenue that they're receiving is higher, I don't know.
But it's interesting, right? Because Cirque du Soleil could be doing all these new experiences, but clearly they're in a lot of debt because they basically took out, the company that bought them took out loans. This is what we assume happened. They took out loans to buy the company, and you put against those loans with the bank, the company. So if you don't pay back the loans, the bank gets to keep Cirque or assets of Cirque. It's pretty common for private equity to do this.
But sir, this is also within the midst of Cirque putting a ton of money into the Broadway show.
Yeah.
I mean, they got a good amount back from
Harry Potter,
but I don't know if that actually covered all of it.
Yeah.
And then they bought this theme park.
I don't know if they bought the theme park, but they're doing the theme park.
It's interesting.
Cirque is very good at making these deals where like they don't necessarily pay for all of it or pay for half of it. And their brand is heavily pushed.
Yeah. I don't know. I think like they must not be doing too poorly. You know,
they have a new logo.
Yeah, they have a new logo. They have, you know, a new ice show and Volta, which isn't that new anymore. But I mean, I'm sure they're not flailing.
No.
But, you know, it's like anyone. It's like everyone on Instagram. I'm doing amazing. And you're internally not.
Yeah.
It's just like the same thing. We're doing great. You know, maybe not so great.
Yeah, we're doing amazing on Instagram and in real life.
Yeah.
So another thing that we saw this week was SpongeBob SquarePants, the Broadway musical.
Yeah. Is that what the full title is? Because they changed it from Chicago, from SpongeBob the musical or something to SpongeBob SquarePants, the Broadway musical.
I don't know exactly, but
I read about it because it's interesting because Nickelodeon, Tina Landau, who directed it, wanted the title to be SpongeBob, just SpongeBob, not SquarePants. But then when they switched it from Chicago to Broadway, Nickelodeon really pushed for SpongeBob SquarePants. I don't know why people get confused, you know, if they didn't have the SquarePants, but they felt like they want to stick to that really well-known brand of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah, I listened to an interview with Kyle Jarrow, who's the writer, and he described it as Armageddon meets Our Town. Mm-hmm. When Lindsay and I saw it, it sort of reminded us of the Broadway musical Paper Bullets. You suggested Shrek when you saw it.
I also, yeah, I thought it reminded me a lot of Shrek and Seussical, the musical. Mm. You know, Seussical and Shrek both did not do well.
They didn't do well. Yeah.
They did not do well. To be upfront, I didn't watch too much SpongeBob when I was younger. Didn't really know all the inside jokes, which clearly there were a lot of, because the audience who were clearly SpongeBob fans were getting it. It was kind of, there's a lot happening on stage. It's hard to.
Yeah. I mean, the New York Times called it sensory overload, which I don't think is inaccurate. My sort of takeaway after seeing it was that if you're a big SpongeBob fan, you love the TV show, you are a fan of the movies, and you're going to like the musical. Mm-hmm. If you're a Broadway person and you're going to see a Broadway musical, I don't know if you'll like it. I mean, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
But it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. You know, following up on our discussion from last week about SpongeBob versus Mean Girls. It also is sort of an interesting indication of the shows that are doing well are not the ones based on these large pre-existing properties. And like 5 years ago,
although Frozen, obviously Harry Potter is doing well, and that's like a really big franchise.
Right. But looking more at the musicals and sort of Disney aside for a moment. I mean, Frozen hasn't opened yet, so we can't even say. And Disney's had flops in the past, so Frozen could be a flop. That 5 years ago, it seemed very hard to get a Broadway theater without being one of these big players, being, you know, a big show backed by Viacom, backed by Disney, or backed by whomever. And the discussion, we weren't doing a podcast back then, but the discussion would have been, where's the place for these small shows that are just musicals, original musicals created for the sake of art or themselves? And now it looks like the pendulum might be swinging the opposite way.
Right. Because when we started, I mean, really when we started Columbia, it was like this wave of no more small original musicals. We're all going to like these source-based materials that have big franchise names. And that's going to be what gets audiences to go because it's easier for marketing. People have brand recognition. You know, they have love for it already. But now, like, they're coming out and people are like, well, it's not as good as the movie, or like, it's not what I thought it would be.
And what's now interesting, right? The Broadway audiences want to go see a Broadway show. Right? So
not like a musicalized version of a movie that they like. Necessarily.
I'm sure there's exceptions to every rule. So yeah. I'm sure there were good versions of it. But I mean, think Rocky, you know, that was another example of that.
Yeah, or, no, I mean, I think we could list a lot of shows that are based on movies and they don't do well. Like Big Fish was a movie-based musical, really did terribly. You know, I think like it'll definitely be interesting to see what happens. But the shows that are doing well, I mean, Hamilton is not a movie musical, you know?
No.
It's a small musical. There's one set. And like, no costume changes the whole time, you know, and it's like really great. And the band's visit too. Very little costume changes. No, there's no costume changes and very little said.
But you ask yourself, like, what are the hit musicals right now? Like Dear Evan Hansen, Hamilton, Band's Visit, maybe Come From Away.
Yep.
And all those shows.
Again, original.
Small, original. What's interesting about SpongeBob is that there's a lot of description of it as an indie musical, but it's an odd combination because something like Dear Evan Hansen, I feel like, is what an indie musical is.
Yeah.
It's pedestrian. It's about, like, people. It's not super glitzy. And SpongeBob, I agree, it started out as an indie surrealist cartoon. But bringing that to Broadway, I could see
It's also strange when they talk about SpongeBob as being an indie musical and then simultaneously in the next sentence being like, it cost $20 million. Those two things seem like not cohesive ideas.
Yeah. But you like SpongeBob, go see SpongeBob. You're not a fan of SpongeBob,
Don't go see SpongeBob. No.
In other news, we spent this past week working with Shannon and Phil, who do this fantastic duo serial act. You'll be able to see them in our upcoming virtual reality experience. But they came to New York and asked for a hand turn in their very family-friendly act into a little bit more edgy for adult shows like Knie's Ooh La La or a place like The Box. And that was a really fun exercise to do all week. You were in the studio with us today. They brought their super cute corgi. You can see it on our Instagram.
It's the cutest dog. It was cool because, you know, I think, like, you've been working with them all week, and I saw a video of the first day, and I just saw the beginning, and then I wanted to not see it again until I saw it live because I want to experience it like a, you know, a viewer would experience it. And it's just so interesting when you just rearrange trick sequences and when they come and the flow of an act and how much more enthralling something can be as an audience member, you know, just like putting one thing here versus here. And I think
picking a good song.
Yeah.
Good interstitial choreography and acting. Hopefully you guys will be able to see their act somewhere. Keep an eye out for them. Follow them on Instagram. Shannon's handle is McGuire56, M-A-G-U-R-E-E 56.
Or you can follow their corgi, which I can't remember her handle, but
super cute.
You should follow her.
On this week's podcast, we are interviewing the evil hate monkey, a.k.a. Adam Crandall. Adam is a multi-award winning, super talented burlesque performer. You may know him from his previous duo act with Trixie Little. They were Trixie and Monkey. Now he's been doing more solo work. He recently was on tour with Briefs, which is an all-male cabaret that if you're a fan of the podcast, you've heard us talk about before. He's got a super interesting story. Starting out doing acting in high school, listening to his journey, entering burlesque, learning some circus, touring around the world. If you have any interest in what that kind of world is like, particularly the burlesque world, what it means, how it relates to circus, then this episode is for you.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Here's our interview with Adam, or the evil hate monkey.
Adam, where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Baltimore, and then my family moved to Florida when I was in fifth grade. But then I would go back to Baltimore for summer camp. So that's, I've always had sort of Baltimore and Florida as home base.
What kind of summer camp?
It's your typical Americana. It was based on American heritage. It has like a Native American aspect to it. And I continue to go to camp like every summer. And
so sleepaway.
Yeah, it's a sleepaway camp. Yeah, it's like 2 week sessions. And I pretty much grew up there. I started going when I was like six. And now there's, I got married there. And then I always had this idea of having like a burlesque summer camp because I always go to these functions with burlesque and it's like Burlesque Hall of Fame and some sort of competition wrapped around it. And I was like, I just want to go. Yeah. Where it's just like fun, like we can just like not have to wear makeup, not have to worry about like competing or whatnot. And so ended up creating a burlesque summer camp, and it was just like for friends, because after the wedding we were like, this was so much fun, we should do it again, but without like the family. The family's great, but it was definitely like a mix of worlds that right. all came together that weekend wedding. And then so finally got that dream of having this thing happen. But then the very first year it happened was the first year I was on with Briefs.
You didn't even get to go.
No, this was the first year that I went, and this was the fifth year that it happened. And it was the first
What's
time.
What's the camp called?
We call it Camp Titicaca or Camp Lovela. It has a couple different names. But yeah, it's just a fun group of people. Yeah.
So were you into performing as a kid? Did you do like the high school plays and musicals?
Well, so I moved to Florida, and then I was into sports and that kind of stuff. And then my brother saw an ad for a children's theater with this guy, Elliot Taubenslag, who was like a New Yorker who like summer or winter bird. What is that what they call
yeah,
it?
Like the yeah. Winter, yeah.
And had done a lot of children's theater in New York. And like he had a post for needing kids to to do children's theater. And so my brother went, and I went with my brother and my dad. I just like went to a company, and I think I was probably in seventh or eighth grade. And Elliot was like, saw me sitting there, and he's like, are you going to audition? And I was like, I'm just kind of like chilling out. And he's like, no, get on stage. And he made me sing Happy Birthday, which actually is not the easiest song, oddly enough.
No, it's
not a great song to sing, but he really just needed bodies. And so he like took me and took my brother. He pretty much anyone that walked through the door, he hired. But that was like the first time. And we had like rehearsals, and he had a couple adult actors and then mostly kids. And we were doing like Little Mermaid was like the first one. We did Peter Pan, Aladdin, like a lot of those Disney type shows. But like we were doing them at the Cinnamon Draft House in West Palm Beach. And then again, my brother, there was a performing arts high school in Florida called School of the Arts. And he auditioned for that and he didn't get in. And it was like, oh, it was really sad. And then I ended up auditioning for the ninth grade, and I got in, and then
that's... Was your brother pissed about
that? I was going to ask.
You know, his life went in a different direction. Like, he was doing a lot of musical theater and show choir at his school, so he was pretty content, and he was also wrestling and swimming and stuff like that. But yeah, so I got into School of the Arts, and that really shifted my life towards more of a performance. Like, the school didn't have... I think we had a soccer team. I think that was like the most we had sports wise. And so I wasn't playing baseball or soccer or any of that stuff anymore. It was just like full on. And the school was amazing. It was like very much that fame sort of thing. And it was a fairly new school. So like when I joined the school in 94, that was the first, the way they started was they started with a 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. And then each year that class would move up and they would add one at the bottom. And so I was the first year that they had a graduating class. So it was a very, like, new school. We had been thrown in this old campus that was, like, from the 60s. And so, like, the arts were just, like, all just, like, flowing everywhere because they didn't really have a good, like system of, it was just like, well, we can put band in this room and we can have arts over here. And so it would all just like intertwined and everything. And then, yeah. And it was, you know, it became where it was just like,
Were your parents supportive of you going down this arts path and going to
totally
arts?
Like, my dad's always been like a pretty out there entertainer, just like the jokester type of guy. So I think he was always liking watching and living vicariously through my brother and I.
So were you focused when you were at high school, were you really focused on like theater?
It was theater and musical theater. But I was also just a stoner kid too, where I was like, I would much rather be out in the lawn, like playing hacky sack or trying to fly a kite. Like, that was the kind of stuff. And yeah. And to this day, I still travel with a kite. Like,
I
have
to
kick it around backstage. Actually, I do travel with a kite a lot of times. We'll get into that later.
Wait, what was your like big role in high school?
Well, I didn't actually. In ninth grade, we did Pippin, which I was really excited about.
Pippin! Yeah. Life and Time.
Yeah.
What were you?
I was the understudy. But then at the end, the grand finale, when they're trying to get him to do the grand finale, I was the one who we made this glass or plexiglass box, and I was like behind it, and we had the science teacher, I forget his name, but filled these balloons with hydrogen or whatever, and then like they like lit them, and so it was just a big fireball, and I'm the person like who's behind it, and everyone's like, isn't that scary? I was like, I'm actually the safest person because I'm protected, and there could be shards of like hot balloons flying at you guys. And yeah, so that wasn't like my big role, but no, we did our school, we did Hair 1 year, which was pretty out there for a high school to do. Instead of like passing a joint, we passed a flower. Sniff the flower, got stoned. So I did all that high school stuff. It was great. And then a lot of everyone was really into, you know, applying for all these prestigious schools, and I was like, oh shit, I guess I should audition and apply to a school. And got into Philly UArts, where they they gave me a scholarship, and I was like, great, I got a scholarship. And I went there, and it was very quickly that I kind of figured out. I was like, oh, they're just giving everyone a scholarship, and they're just raising the tuition price to pay for it and just giving. And it was definitely, they were in a time of flux, I felt like, where they were expanding their programming across the board. And so they were just taking a ton of people to pay for it. And the first year I just sat there in like my theater acting class. I was like, it was all stuff that I had like been taught like in 11th grade. Right. Like I was like, my base was so much further along, and they were also very much like Broadway, ya-cha-cha. Yeah. And I was just like, this is not what I want to do. I was like, this is not what like my training. And then like my friend from high school, he was doing really well here in New York, and I was like, he was at Circle in the Square, and then like got into shows, and I was like, I just want to get out of this like school. And then my roommate, he had dropped out, and then I had a friend who from high school who was like, hey man, I'm hiking the Appalachian Trail. And I was like, great. I was like, told my parents that I was going to drop out of school and hike the trail, and they were like, well, give it at least another semester. And I was like, okay. So I did another semester, and I left after, so I did 2.5 years of college, and then started hiking the trail, and it was on the trail for like 3 months. And
was it like that movie with Reese Witherspoon where like, you know, her feet get like terrible sores?
Yeah, all the 30 pounds. She was out there on her own though. I'm actually wearing the actual boots that I hiked the trail in 2000.
They're still they don't in good look very shape. Worn
down. I know, these are 17 years old. It's crazy. The trail was such a eye-opening, magical experience, and that really sort of set the tone for a lot of, like, figuring out my path, like, where it is a wanderlust, looking for new adventure, and that was the beginning of, like, a big adventure. And then met a girl on the trail who was going to be settled down in this little town of Damascus, Virginia, and because she had met this man, Mountain Man, who the year before, because she was biking across country with her sister, and so, which she did, she completed bicycling across the country, and met her, and like, she was supposed to be working for this guy, Mountain Man, and I was in town, and I was doing some work for Mountain Man, and then we met, and then
his name is Mountain Man?
Well, on the trail, everyone has different names, like, you go by, you're not your...
So you're not Adam.
No, I was Broadway. which Lone Wolf gave me that name, which was he was a hobo hiker. The hobo hikers are just these guys who just, they're usually like Navy SEALs and stuff like that, like Vietnam vets and whatnot. And they just live on the trail in the summer, and they just sort of like hike around. They jump, like, we'll get a ride, but it's just easier living. They just enjoy just being out.
And they just give you names.
Well, everyone just sort of gets a name. Like, you can give yourself a name, but usually the name is given to you. And oddly enough, you remember more people's names because of it, because their name fits them.
Yeah.
You know, like, mine was given, like, I was, like, stoking the fire and had been telling them where I'd come from and, like, theater and this and that. And, like, I did something, and Lone Wolf, like, just turned and looked, and he's like, fucking A, Broadway. And it was just like, Broadway, there it is. It's just, like, done.
Stuck.
Yeah. And, like, my friend that I was hiking with, like, he was studying to be a school teacher, and his name is Chalkboard. Mm. You know, so it was really interesting. And, like, the trail was a magical thing. It was, like, 3 months on the trail, maybe hiking for two of it. Like, a lot of it was, like, pit stops. Like, yeah, just a wild, weird time.
Finding yourself, though.
Yeah, and met the girl, and then got off the trail. We ended up driving, helping my brother move out to L.A., and then she ended up working at camp, because I continued to work at camp until I was in my
20s. So the girl you met, you started dating?
Yeah, we started dating.
What was her like, pseudonym or whatever?
Well, she wasn't a hiker. Her name, she had been biking the year before.
Oh, the biking, right,
yeah,
the biking girl,
yeah, Megan. And because she was supposed to work at Mountain Man's for the summer, and he didn't have his crap together at all at this restaurant that he was putting together. So we met her, and that's where, like, the traveling really started. And then I ended up going, where was it? So after we worked at summer camp, and then I was out of college, didn't know what I was going to do. And she was going to school in Iowa. So I was like, well, I'll just go and live with you for a little bit. And then we were like, formulated this plan that we were going to go and travel in Europe. So we just worked our asses off for like a semester. Like I did concrete foundations in Iowa during the winter and like froze my tits off. It was so, so cold. But it was one of those jobs where I was like, I know I'm going to leave this. So I'm just giving it my all. It's kind of like my philosophy anyway. And it was great. And then like by the end, they were like, are you sure you want to go? You're really good at this. And I'm like, I am not sticking around to do this. No way. I'm like, I'm out. And then Megan and I went to Europe for 2 months. We cycled around Ireland for a month.
Did you see any shows while you were there? Anything that's like artistically inspiring or just...
We just went to a lot of museums, really. Like, we did a month with a bus ticket tour thing, which I wouldn't recommend. I don't know if they still do it, but it was like Euro Pass. Like, I would do the train thing, but the bus thing was... It was like we bought this month-long bus thing, but you could only travel from country to country. You couldn't inner travel. If like you wanted like a couple places in France, you would have to like go to Italy first and then come back to the other. Yeah, so it was like a lot of like bus... like and then but then we rounded it out with cycling for a month in we started in Cork and went up the west coast of Ireland and then over to Belfast and then into Scotland.
So when did you first see burlesque, like when does that enter your life?
So then I did all that traveling with Megan and she was like I'm gonna go back to school, and I was like, I think I'm gonna move
to
back.
Ireland.
Yeah, she was like, she wanted to go back to school. She had taken like the semester off, and I was like, I don't know what I want to do. I was like, I feel like I want to go and move back to Maryland, move back to Baltimore. And I had a friend there, and we had been talking, and he was like a song musician and whatnot, and it was like, all right, I'll move there. And Megan and I just sort of realized that it was like our time together was coming to an end, and it was fine. It was mutual. And so I moved back to Baltimore and met Trixie, and we started dating. I was working at a nonprofit, Living Classrooms, and she was working there, working with inner city kids, not performing, really doing anything. But she had started this big performance group called Fluid Movement, which is a still going strong now, like, I don't know, 15 years in, maybe more. But it was community-based water ballets, and that's where it started. She really wanted to see, like, these big community-based productions. And then they started doing roller skating shows as well, and they brought me into the show, this roller skating show. It was Nessie on Wheels. It was, like, a sort of... what's Mulder and Scully? X-Files. It was, like, an X-Files meets... the Loch Ness Monster on roller skates.
Yeah. Were you the monster?
No, I was the detective, the Mulder. Is that how you say his name? Mulder, right?
Yeah, probably. I never watched the X-Files.
Yeah, I never watched it.
I probably would like it.
Yeah, and we were dating and whatnot, but then she wanted, she had...
How old are you at this point?
22, I guess.
Oh, wow, so you guys met when you were really young.
Yeah, because I'd gotten off the trail. I turned 21 on the trail. And then in 2000, it was right after 9/11 that I moved back to Baltimore. And then, so she had been researching and getting into, like, coming up to New York and seeing, like Miss Astrid at Fez and shows like that. And, like, she was interested in burlesque. And then it was the beginning of that movement, the whole, like, neo-burlesque movement. And... on her merit of Fluid Movement, she had gotten into Teaserama out in San Francisco, and she was supposed to do an act with one of her friends, and her friend backed out like about a month before, and she called me, and at the time I was like helping my parents build a house in North Carolina, and she's like, hey, we're gonna do this thing, it's, you're gonna be the evil hate monkey, I'm gonna be Trixie Little. She had already called me Monkey anyway, and people at work called her Trixie just because she was like petite and sprightly.
Yeah.
And
why do people call you Monkey?
Well, she called me Monkey because I'm hairy and I like to climb things and whatnot. Okay. And at the time, it was Trixie Little and the evil tap dancing hate monkey. That was the official, because I had a little bit of tap from high school and college, and it's a horrific name.
That's a long
name. Yeah, don't do that.
And the evil tap dancing hate monkey.
Yeah, well, MC's definitely got it wrong. Like, Scotty the Blue Bunny and Murray Hill, like when we started coming to, like, New York Burlesque Festival, like, that's when I realized, because I think Scotty called me, like, the evil tape boy hate monkey guy. Yeah. And I was like, oh, all right. Note to self. Yeah, shorten. I mean, even now it's just pretty much just monkey because it's not even that hateful these days. Yeah. So she just kind of was like, hey, we're going to do this thing. And I was like, great. Yeah, sure. That's fine. And I was like, what's burlesque? Like, I really didn't know anything about it. But that was like the intro to the world of it. And we went out there, like Dita Von Teese was in the show.
Oh, wow.
It was like, and it was still in that time where like we didn't even send like a video, you know, it was just like,
just come.
Right. This is what we're going to do.
What did you guys do? What was like your first thing you did?
Well, we approached it with a more theatrical based through line. And so there was that idea that it was like Trixie and Monkey, this comic book sort of characters where it was like love and hate, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. So like, I think the first one was like I was banana farming and something to all the men in the world. And like her tagline was that she could spank love into the world one bare bottom at a time. And so there was that, like, she had to come in and defeat the monkey and then spank the monkey and make love happen all over again. So that was like sort of the beginning. And we'd written like a full length, like 45 minute show or whatever. When we first, like, that's how we first jumped into burlesque. Wow. Was not just like creating an act. We created a whole show with like a script and like some friends. And, so we were doing that for a while in the beginning. Like, we kept like writing these like long shows and always trying to rope in friends to do it, who it was fun for them. And then, but it was also a lot of time. It was very time consuming, and we were realizing that we were really enjoying it. And so that's when we started broke off and started doing more just like solo stuff. And then
together,
solo, yes. Duo work
without
other people. Right. Yes.
Pieces that are acts.
Yes.
Opposed to shows.
Yeah. Vignettes.
Yeah.
Opposed to a long mm-hmm. storyline show.
You're doing it mainly still in California.
Baltimore and New
Baltimore.
York.
Oh, you came back to Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, California, the thing in San Francisco was just like a weekender event.
But that was like your first.
That was my first.
And then you came back to Baltimore.
I think we might have done the full-length show in Baltimore first to get ready for it. Uh-huh. And then we took like a snippet from it, like a five-minute mm-hmm. section of that. Mm-hmm.
Is there a good scene in Baltimore for burlesque? Or just for performance in general?
Baltimore is a great, great place. Like, I haven't been there in a while. I mean, I just did a show there recently, but to actually live there and know what's going on. But there is a really cultivating art scene, and they're really, because it's scrappy, like, you can kind of do whatever you want mm-hmm. and people will come out and support it, and they're not like really pretentious about mm-hmm. it and creating new stuff. I think when Trixie and I started, like, we were kind of like the first like wave of the new burlesque, even though Baltimore is stoked with like burlesque history. Like, there's the Block, which is a one block, which is just strip clubs mm-hmm. across the street from each other, like the whole block. And then you have the police department right next door, like the main police department. But you've got like the 2 o'clock club, which was like Blaze Starr owned. So it's like, there's so much rich history there, mm. but it's now just,
would you describe what the neo-burlesque movement is to somebody who's not familiar with it?
Sure. I could try to. I want to say it started in like the late 90s, early 2000s, and it was just people doing burlesque, but how they wanted to do it, you know, not necessarily having to stick to the regular idea of just a fan dance, mm-hmm. you know, or a boa, or, you know, like, because burlesque has, and I'm not a historian, so I don't want to really be quoted on it, but like, it changed a lot through history, and a lot of it changed because of porn, you know, because like, in a sense, like, burlesque was your porn before porn happened, mm-hmm. you know. And then, and that's what's like sort of changed it. So it sort of like fell off for a while. Like, it was still sort of happening. There still was burlesque happening, but not the way it was like in the 50s, you know, when people could start getting full nude and whatnot. And so then the revival was really like bringing it back to an art form and making it about the art of taking your clothes off. Like, that's the difference, I think, burlesque from like stripping at a strip club.
Yeah.
There's some sort of thought line or through line, not that it always has to, but that happens. And then there's, I lost my train of thought. Oh, like you could have it in a, you can add comedy into it. Like, you don't really see a lot of comedy at a strip club, you know? And then there's duos, there's groups, burlesque. The thing about burlesque is that anyone can do it. But I think, and this is a greater, a deeper conversation, I think that also has diluted it a lot. The fact that anyone can do it.
Mm.
And that's the difference that I'm seeing right now, wherein, especially coming from like from the burlesque world, moving into like a circus world, and then sort of coming back to a burlesque world and like comparing the two and seeing a difference. And for me, there's something really tangible about circus, where you can view circus and you could say, that person can juggle. Yes. That person can do trapeze. There's something you can actually judge someone on. Not necessarily, not that that makes them a good performer.
Right.
No. But it just changes your interaction with it.
Yeah. There's something that you can look at and actually say, where burlesque, it's a lot harder to find. It's about like the performer. Yeah, like
it's they more have like to, acting in that way.
Yeah, they've got and I think a lot of people, like, they take some classes or whatnot, or they start from a costume background and they make this amazing costume, but are just shit performers. And it's like, a costume does not make you a good performer.
Yeah.
No.
Well, we were kind of talking about this because, you know, we saw the Boylesque Festival in New York, and like our real my real introduction, not Josh's, but to like this whole boylesque or whatever scene was really seeing Club Briefs in Australia, which was like insanely amazing.
Right.
And that's like the level that you start at in my head.
Yeah.
And then we go to this and I was like, this is not what I thought.
There's so much more circus and tangible skill in Briefs than there was at the Boylesque Festival, which I think helps with the long form.
Yeah.
Seeing seven or eight acts when you have some circus done in there.
I mean, even like the night that you were in, where it was like, you know, so many acts. And then, you know, you come on and it's like, oh, okay, like this is what.
As the finale.
As the finale. You know, and no wonder they put you there. But I see what you're saying, totally.
But I think, so we met originally at the Box, probably like in 2009. And I always thought that one of the things that made, and I hope you like the categorization, but putting you and Trixie and Rose and a few other people, Narcissister for some of her acts, in this special category, was the theatrical element and the storytelling element and the specific character element. And I think it's moved more into circus as well. I think some circus acts are adopting it. But I was always just super impressed. And the one that really comes to mind that left me that initial impression was your Total Eclipse of the Heart act.
Yeah.
Where it's just so built in with clear characters, clear narrative is happening. It's tied into the music. There's circus tricks in it that have that punctuation. I'm wondering if you can also talk a little bit about like how you craft these acts and what the process of thinking about it is, and the role of costume and the role of music.
Right. Well, Total Eclipse was...
Will you describe that?
Because
I actually don't know which one.
So, Total Eclipse is the Bonnie Tyler. Trixie and I used to do an act to Total Eclipse, Bonnie Tyler's Total Eclipse.
Which I can actually sing in German.
Can you?
Sei bereit, manchmal in der Nacht schwicht die wieder steht. I can sing the whole thing in German.
That's amazing. bitter. Is that good? I don't even know. So, we were. Trixie and I had been taking some classes, and we went to a performance conference, and it happened to be in Baltimore, called MiniFest, which stemmed from Motion Fest. This guy, Mike Rossman, is a great performer in Baltimore, does a lot of like the Ren Fairs and stuff like that. He and some other people had this thing, Motion Fest, which like Hillary Chaplin, is that how you say it? Like, she was a teacher there. There was a lot of like real circusy
people,
folk. And we were coming at it from like a burlesque world. And like, we came there and they were like, what is this? And they were really enjoying it. And so that's like, it was interesting to be in that world together. And we were into like the acrobatic stuff. But with Total Eclipse, it was Trixie really loved that song, and we would just like listen to it like constantly, and like we were like painting the house, and we were like listening to Total Eclipse, and we were like, we're gonna do something to this. And then we went to Minifest, which was like it was like a 3-day little retreat conference, and they had a every night at Motion Fest or Minifest at the time, they had critiques at night where you had 15 minutes to present something, and you could use all of your 15 minutes. You could use 2 minutes. It doesn't matter, but you have 15 minutes and everyone just watches and they write down notes on a note card and then they turn in the note cards. And then with the remaining left amount of time, they just read off the note cards and you're not allowed to respond at all. You just sit and listen, which we thought was brilliant because so many times people take criticism and have to be like, well, what I was trying to do was this. And it was like, just, this is what we watched. This is what we witnessed. Yeah. So just take it.
Yeah.
And we've used that format in like when taking it to like BurleyCon, like which is a burlesque convention, like using that for act development where it was just like, just throw something up on stage. It doesn't matter. And so we took that moment and we were like in our hotel room and we were like, okay, listening to Total Eclipse. We're like, okay, we'll do this here and then we'll do that. All right. And this will punctuate there. And then we'll start with the flashlights. And we just threw it up for 5 minutes. And they were like, this is amazing. This is great. And like, that was really what it took for that act to happen. But we'd been sitting on the song for months, you know, listening to it. So it like was in us and knew how to like flow with it, like, and where it needed to go. And like, we knew that we were going to be doing like some acrobatic stuff to be taking off the clothes. And
did
like,
did you take classes at NECA?
Yep, we went to school. We did their 9-month
pro track.
Yeah, we were the first 9-month pro track.
Is anybody else in your class like Kevin Beverly? Or
they Kevin, Mr. Gorgeous. They were all the year after us. We had, I don't know if there's any people that
what
you
was
would
that
know.
Like doing circus, like a circus pro track, I mean, from this world of like theater and,
well,
and
it was
burlesque.
Well, it was we had, at that moment in our careers, like our burlesque career was doing fairly well. Like we were getting.
Were you still in Baltimore at this time, or?
Yes, we were living in Baltimore. I think we had already won duo at Burlesque Hall of Fame in Vegas, and so we were getting asked to go to different countries and different festivals. Because at this point, you know, like from the time that we had started, now like 6 years into it or whatever, maybe like there's a lot of these burlesque festivals cropping up everywhere. And
what did you guys do at the Hall of Fame?
The year we won?
Yeah.
The year we won, we did an act which was like a detective sort of like monkey was running around doing bad things. And I think it was like stealing socks or I don't know. But like, but then Detective Trixie, it was a very like film noir thing. And she comes in and beats me, defeats me. Yeah. Oddly enough, this backtrack for a second, how we sort of got into acrobatics. That's a funny, we started doing, when we were dating, we were doing swing dancing as like a fun Monday night, like thing to do. And neither of us were really good at the actual dancing.
But there's some good acrobatic tricks.
Right. And we were enjoying the acrobatic tricks. And, by this point, Trixie had already taken a couple classes with Elsie and Serenity and knew about like NECA and the farm. And at that time, they were, what were they even operating out of? Like
the
we took class.
The top floor of that warehouse building?
That, the cotton mill. Yeah. Yeah, but we were taking classes in the barn on the property that they were like living at. They had Yeah. So we'd go up there, we'd work with Bill and he would teach us some like acro stuff and we would literally, like, whatever we learned, we would put it into an act. Like, that's how we were like, oh, you know. And so, in the beginning, like, acts were coming out pretty quick because we were like, let's use this, let's use that. And then when NECA offered the pro track thing, we were like, okay. And we talked to them. We were like, we'd like to come and do it, but we think we could only do, like, 3 months. Or I think we said 3 months. Yeah, we were like, that's all we can really muster. And then within like a week or two of being up there, we're like, we've got to be here for the whole time. Like there's no, we're not going to get anything out of this if we don't. So we like decided to do it and stay there. And like, we would literally drive from like Vermont to New York almost every weekend and do like Thursday, Friday, Saturday in the city working at like with like Angie Pontani and Murray Hill at like Choreo. They had like a weekly thing there on Friday and Saturday. And then we'd run over to the Box, and the Box would hire us for just those three nights because of Total Eclipse. Like, it was such a good closer. It was funny because we were originally hired by the first person who was hiring people at the Box. I don't even remember her name at the time, but so we came down and we were like, okay, we're in the show tonight. And we'd never been to the Box, didn't know anything about it really. And we get there and they're like, okay, you can come down here and you can get dressed. And this was like during the afternoon, and we're like, they brought us down to like the women's bathroom, like the sex bathroom, you know, and we're like looking around and we're like, we get changed here. I was like, what's going on? And I was like, I think we're auditioning. Oh. It's like, I don't think we're actually hired yet. I think we have to audition. And it was like, oh, we do. And like, did our act for Simon. And he was like, yep. He's like, this is great. He's like, let's put it in tonight. He's like, can you guys just get naked at the end? And I was like, ooh. And like, we'd never like been faced with that, you know, like.
Because how did your act originally end?
Just in a G-string.
Yeah.
Pasties for her. Me in a, like a furry thong or something like that. And we like looked at each other and we're like kind of like talked about it and we're like, well, it actually makes sense. Like it's not gratuitous. Like it leads to that, like in the progression of the act. And it was like
the finale is you guys ripping off your clothing and doing the dirty dancing.
Yeah, the dirty dancing lift. Yeah.
Totally naked.
Yeah. Cool. And like holding her up and turning and like her sliding down. And,
oh, I think I've seen this maybe like that moment.
Yeah. And it made sense, and it was like, okay, and we did it, and then that just sort of, like, solidified our stake in the Box for a long time, and then...
That's such a good transition. I've always been curious why there isn't more real nudity in the burlesque scene.
I think there...
I've seen, at least. Is it what I'm seeing?
I think it's what you're seeing. Like, yeah. Over at the Slipper Room, there's a lot of nudity, I think. And sometimes I think it's gratuitous, and sometimes I think it's fine, you know? Yeah. It just depends. And I think it also depends on, like, the time of night at the Slipper Room. You know, it's, like, the actual flow. Like, on a Friday night or something, if someone comes out and is, like, full vag at, like, 9:30 or 10 o'clock, it sets the wrong tone for the rest of the evening. Right. You know, it has to have a bit of an arc. Even though it's still just a variety show, there still needs to be some sort of overall flow.
Having said that, though, just jumping around, when we saw Club Briefs, penis out first number. Basically, after Fez intros.
Louis.
Yeah, Louis. Well, I think that is... Yeah. Which I think, but that's also setting the tone for what kind of night you're in for.
And it was it was like the hardest start I've ever... Well, I should have
the
said
hardest it. Start. Was it? I've never seen it that hard.
That was like, the most... Like, not aggressive in a bad way, but like, it really was like, okay, here like, here we go. Like, this is... what we're going to see, or, like, this is the show.
Yeah.
But, like, again, the burlesque... I mean, I think we have to... I need to go to see some burlesque that you recommend.
I would... I always like starting at Slipper. Like, that, to me, is still, like, the New York place. Because then it at least gives it the proper, like, home and space for it. So it's not like in the back room of like a dingy bar with like some can lights, you know, there's some thought process into it. It has a good,
it's well designed.
Yeah. It's designed. It was designed with burlesque in mind. Like when we built that place, we built it with those parameters, you know, like making sure there's ceiling height. So Ariel can be in there.
Wait, you say we built it.
I was, on the build of the Slipper Room.
The rebuild? The first build?
The rebuild.
Yeah.
Yep. So I forget how many years ago it was now, but it was like 6 or 7 years ago. Yeah. But yeah, so they raised the building and then the new building, it used to just be one floor. Mm-hmm. And then Slipper Room had them, I don't know what the whole deal was, but basically they have the second and third floor. Mm-hmm. And so it was designed with like, okay, this is all the dimensions. And then, yeah, like, I mean, things like I talked to James, I was like, I did like all the tile work in the place and hung the curtains. I mean, like all kinds of stuff, you know. And at one point, I was like, "Oh, we should have a heated floor in the dressing room because we're always barefoot and it gets cold." And he's like, "Yeah, go for it." So it's like,
that's a great space to Slipper Room.
Yeah, but yeah, the Slipper is a good place to, I think, to go and see stuff. But to be honest, like I've been out of the scene
right
for for a good, like, almost 4 years.
Let's talk about that. What took you, what, how did Briefs come about, and would you also describe what Briefs is a little bit?
Sure. So Briefs is a collective, well, it's a company, Briefs, and then the larger umbrella is Briefs Factory, which then runs a couple different shows. But Briefs, the show that I was in, is an all-male burlesque vaudeville trash circus show. And with the fearless leader of Fez and Captain Kid, Mark, those two are like the creative geniuses behind it. Basically, they, in 2012, I think it was, they were... They were doing Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and they had just created their new show, The Second Coming, and they had done it in Brisbane, and they were about to go to Edinburgh for a month, and then they had Ireland and about a month run in London as well, and at the Wonderground. And basically, this guy dropped out like about, I don't know, a couple weeks before they were about to go. And they knew that I was going to be in England because I was going to be doing the box in England. And they called me. They were at the river in Australia. And they were like, Monkey, are you available for 3 months, you know, to do Edinburgh Fringe? And I was like, looked at my calendar and I was like, well, I was going to miss the burlesque summer camp, which I was about to. And I was like, yeah, okay. And it looked at it and I was like, this is a great opportunity to be able to go to Edinburgh Fringe Festival with, like, without that idea of, like, the struggle. Like I definitely felt like I jumped a couple of rungs on a ladder, where it was like I was able to just be in a show that was being produced. I was getting paid. I had a place to stay. Like, all the stuff that you would dream about when you're going to Edinburgh Fringe.
Taken care of.
Yeah, taken care of. And I was like, this is no brainer. I'm going to do this. It's a good opportunity. I had already met Mark and Fez. Like, I passed the crown to Mark in 2011. I won in 2010 in Vegas, and he won in 2011. That's when we first met. And so, yeah, so I was like, yeah, sure, I can join. I can rearrange some stuff. And so went and learned the choreography real quick, like on a weekend. Like, they were in Cardiff, and I like jumped over from London, went to Cardiff, and like Monday and Tuesday learned like the fan dance, and like had a week to work on it. And they went to do a different festival in England, and then we all met in Edinburgh, and like it was like bam, just had to like jump right in. But oddly enough, like my role into it like really helped solidify the show, and everyone, I didn't see the show before it, but everyone sort of agrees that it like all of a sudden it felt like it, all the pieces were actually there. Mm-hmm. Like my role was more of like that comedic clown character that was like the through point. So yeah, just pop up here and there, but also have a full act. And so yeah, it was supposed to be for 3 months, and then it turned into like 3.5 years. Cause like from Fringe Festival, like things just sort of took off. Like we got a 3 month gig in Hamburg over the Christmas time. And then, you know, as soon as, like, the ball gets rolling, it just goes out of control. And they already had solidified themselves definitely in the Australian market, Fringe, like, in Perth, Adelaide. Mm-hmm. And so started doing that. And I was, like, tag-teaming, doing Briefs and Trixie and Monkey, like, our circus shows that we had been creating, like, these hour-long shows and whatnot. So trying to tag-team as much as possible for a while.
So, like, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but, like, when you have a partner...
Mm-hmm.
Who basically the, you know, your characters are created together.
Yeah.
And you go away to do a show.
Yep.
How is that?
I think was probably harder for her because she was the one left alone.
Yeah.
And I was all of a sudden had an even larger pool of people to be working with. So I was fortunate for that. So yeah, it was definitely difficult for her, I would think.
Did you guys have to, like, basically kind of, I mean, not reinvent, but kind of rediscover, like, what the, like, purpose or motivation of your characters were without the other? Or your, like, persona?
I don't necessarily think I thought about it all that much. I think it might have just naturally happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've become less evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this lovable...
The characters become
less evil. Yes, the character, the evil hate monkey is... I mean, it's more like the mischievous monkey or something, yeah. You know, like throwing bananas.
The most evil thing... Oh my God, I got a banana peel in my face. I know. Yay. You throw bananas. I was like, I'm watching you. And then for 1 second, I like stopped being on guard and then banana peel right in my face.
I threw one once at Slipper Room and... I'm just like wildly gesticulating, throwing them, and I hit the soundboard and it cut my music off. And I was like, I did that to myself.
That was you.
Yeah, that was my fault.
So, but you didn't do the most recent, brief show. You came back to New York.
Yes. So about a year ago, I had a conversation with Fez and I was like, I feel like I need a break. Been like living out of a suitcase. I put all my stuff into storage. Trixie and I got divorced. A whole lot of things happened in my life, and it was just like, I need a little bit of a break and a breather. I need to like step away from this and sort of reevaluate a little bit. I need a break. And so they're like, okay, I think we can give you like 6 months or something. We'll figure something out. And also like Dallas Delaforce had already left the show, which was like the drag component. Mm-hmm. And then someone else is leaving, and just all the factors of like different people leaving. I think it was evident to them that they needed to create a new show.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. So they created the new show that they have now. And Close Encounters. Yep.
I was going to say Brief Encounters.
Brief Encounters, yes. It's Close Encounters, which is a brilliant show. Like, I went and saw it in London. So great. So great. I'm so proud of the guys. Like, it's a different show than our show. It has some new members.
I think
Harry's in the show. Harry Clayton Wright, and it's a more dance driven show, mm. which I think is really cool that they, and it's also has a lot more like political bite to the show, which I think also stems from the connection with Brief's Factory working with Hot Brown Honey, and which is an amazing show that I don't know if you've talked about that or not. Have you guys seen Hot Brown Honey?
No, what is that? Okay.
Hot Brown Honey is the sister show to Brief's.
But it's all women, right?
It's all women, women of color, and it's...
Linda was telling us?
Yeah, Linda would... Yeah. Yeah, so Brief's Factory produces it, so Linda produces it. And it's just a raw, amazing woman power, but political and great circus, music... beatbox, like all the stuff, an amazing set. They have this like giant like beehive thing that lights up.
I was hearing that.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's gonna, their thing is like world pollination. So I think they're gonna be in Canada soon. I think, or maybe no, they're in Manchester. I don't. They'll definitely be touring through the U.S. I think in the next year or two for sure. Yeah, it's such a great show.
But you may not be doing Breeze, but now you're doing still shows here. I mean, I love the title of your all animal character show, Monkey's Ass Menagerie.
Monkey's Ass Menagerie.
It's just the best.
Yeah, thanks.
Best show title.
Yeah, that was fun. That was just stemmed from knowing that Scotty the Blue Bunny was going to be in town for the New York Burlesque Festival, and I feel like we had joked about it at one point, like, oh, we should have an all animal show, and then I was thinking back to my theater years of the Glass Menagerie, and then I was like, oh, the Ass Menagerie, and all, and then like looking around at like performers that I like a lot in here in New York, and I was like, oh, they've got an animal act, they've got an animal. I was like, oh, great, we'll just do like a barnyard ballyhoo burlesque whatever with Scotty hosting, and he was like, yeah, let's do it. So yeah, I mean, it was more of a conceptual idea that just sort of happened, but and I think it could have legs if we got it together again, for sure. Yeah, it was fun.
Sweet. So the first question that we ask all of our guests is, has there been a piece of advice, good or really bad, that somebody has given you that stuck with you?
There was my high school teacher, Miss Blanchette. She used to always say, make it bigger, when we were doing acts or doing scenes and stuff like that. And I was like, ugh, which is really... it's almost counterintuitive to a lot of like the theater training that you get, like you don't want to make it bigger because, you know, and it was like, and I used to laugh about that. And then like going into college, it was like, no, but then getting into like the burlesque world and circuit, like it all of a sudden sort of started to resonate. And it was like, oh, I can make it bigger. Doesn't necessarily mean that's what you end up presenting on stage, but that concept of thinking big and making something bigger is a better place, I think, to like start from, and then you can fine tune down. Like But if you are self-directing and censoring yourself from, like, the beginning of your creative process, then you're not going to really get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So, oddly enough, like, the make it bigger, it works now in my life. Make it bigger! Yeah, it's, like, not something I really like, but yes. But making it bigger is, it can work if you think about it in the right way.
Yeah. Great. The second question is, for somebody who is maybe a student at ProTrack or just, you know, interested in getting into the burlesque scene or circus scene, is there a show or a movie or a book or any just reference material you suggest that they watch or read or take a look at?
I think it's important to go and see shows, go and see as many different types of shows, so you're not pigeonholing yourself into one category, and then you can take things from it. I don't think I actually have, like, a necessarily specific one, and I probably don't do it as much as I used to. I think when I was when I was at fringe festivals and stuff, I would make it a point to try to go and see a bunch of things, also because you could get into them for free, so if you've got the pass, whatever. That point, it was like, why wouldn't you go and see as much as you can? Like, you shouldn't be laying in bed, you know? It's like, I'm gonna go and see this, and, like, I would just take a chance and be like, oh, that sounds interesting, and just go and see that stuff. And, you know, traveling around with briefs in that circus community, especially the Australian circus community, it's so tight, and everyone's so lovely and knows everyone. You tend to, like, keep going to some of the same shows that you've seen, and it was like, all right, I've seen that. I want to go and see some other things. But in New York, I mean, it's still like going to the Box to see what that is, just to see what it is. And going to the Slipper Room, going to Nurse Betty, you know, just go and see the stuff.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Last question.
Sure.
Who do you think we should have on the podcast?
Well, I think Olivia said this, but I agree with Fez would be a great person to chat to.
He still has said one of, like, my most favorite lines I've ever heard in my life, the, like, jealous thing.
Jealous. Yes. I mean, he's a creative genius. I don't know how he operates on a day-to-day basis. It's he's the most loving, giving, making everyone feel welcome, and still manages to smash out so much stuff in a day-to-day basis with so many things going on and different moving pieces and parts. It's like, it'd be interesting to, like, get inside that brain and understand how it actually works.
Yeah,
because I think we'd all be better people if we could operate like that.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Yeah,
great.
Have you spoken to Hubby?
Oh, I've tried to get Hubby like 3 or 4 times, and just, it's all about timing and timing. Getting the right,
we saw him
right
on
moment of attention.
Monday at the Bindle Stiff.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Well, Adam, Monkey, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
This is great.
Yay. Enjoy.
And that was our interview with Adam.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, Twitter tweet us, or you can email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Have a great week, everybody.
Bye.